This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraqi forces raise the flag over Ramadi. The United States prepares for a new year in the Pacific.
The balancing act, if you will, between trying to reassure allies and partners in Southeast Asia in particular, but all throughout Asia, that the U.S. is there, is responsive to its military alliance commitments.
Prison food takes on a whole new meaning. A Shakespeare classic plays at the movies. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Iraqi army units supported by Sunni tribal fighters and a mostly Shiite police brigade have captured the center of the Anbar province capital, Ramadi. The national flag was raised over the main government compound in Ramadi Monday, 7 months after Islamic State militants captured the western city. The apparent victory by Iraqi security forces, backed by U.S.-led airstrikes, is the biggest since the IS group came on the scene in force 18 months ago. Edward Uranian has details at our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Iraqi state TV broadcast grainy footage of government forces climbing onto the roof of Ramadi's municipal headquarters and raising the Iraqi flag. The city center fell to Islamic State militants in May when soldiers defending the same government complex fled. Provincial Governor Suhaib Rawi addressed residents of Anbar. He says that retaking the government complex from Islamic State marks the start of the liberation of the rest of Anbar province. He thanks tribal fighters, the Iraqi Air Force, and the Prime Minister for helping to win the battle so families can return to their homes. He also thanks U.S.-led coalition forces for providing air cover for the operation. Video of Ramadi city center and other nearby districts showed widespread destruction and many neighborhoods appeared to be in ruins. One military commander told state TV that Islamic State militants had booby-trapped many buildings and attacked his men with car bombs. He says that his men made sacrifices and many gave up their lives in the bitter battle against Islamic State, which hit them with car bombs, mines, and by rigging buildings. Provincial Governor Rawi claimed that 1,000 Islamic State fighters were killed in the battle to recapture Ramadi. Arab media reported, however, that many fled through tunnels and escaped across the Euphrates River, which runs north of the city. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
There remains uncertainty, however, as some Iraqi military leaders say Ramadi's been liberated, while others contend parts of the city remain under Islamic State control. A U.S. military official says Islamic State fighters had been driven out of critical infrastructure in Ramadi, but declined to declare a total victory for Iraqi forces in the city. Middle East regional analyst Amin Saikal of the Australian National University in Canberra tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that regaining control of Ramadi would not only be a big victory for the Iraqi government, but a significant loss by the Islamic State, which also gave up the area around the strategic Tishrin Dam in northern Syria to a rebel alliance known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. He says it took Iraqi forces weeks to complete their assault on Ramadi.
Yeah, and it's not the end of the story yet. I mean, it is very possible that the Islamic State may launch a counterattack. And also, as far as the latest news is concerned, there is still fighting going on in and around Ramadi. So I don't think the Iraqi armed forces can declare a full victory at this point. But of course, they are very close to achieving a victory.
Despite the fall of Tikrit to Iraqi forces earlier this year, this is being considered the biggest victory in 18 months since Islamic State made its presence known in Iraq.
Well, that is absolutely true. And of course, that will also boost the morale of the Iraqi forces and will enable them in cooperation with the Kurdish militia Peshmerga to make a very strong push towards the second largest city of Iraq, that's Mosul, which has been under the control of the Islamic State since June last year.
Well, that's going to be a much bigger test for the Iraqi security forces.
Absolutely, because the Mosul is highly urbanized, and the Islamic State has embedded most of its military assets as well as its fighters among the population. So therefore, I think the risk of higher civilian casualties would be something that the Iraqi forces and the international coalition would have to really take into account. And that may well not make it easy for them to make us push into Mosul as easily as some people may have anticipated.
Is this a political victory for Haider al-Abadi, the prime minister?
Well, it is a victory of a kind, but of course one must not really forget that Mr. al-Abadi had promised last year that they were going to take over Ramadi within a very short space of time. Within days and weeks, but of course that never really materialized. And it's taken them almost a year to make a trust into Ramadi, and does not necessarily mean that they're going to have a sort of a similar easy victory in relation to Mosul.
What does this all mean for the Islamic State? Has it reached its peak, or is it still a major menace that is spreading?
Well, it is still a source of important menace for the region as well as beyond the region. And also it shows that the Islamic State is contained. It has not really achieved any major territorial victory in the last several months. And they're also losing grounds to some extent in Syria, and they have lost some strategic points. But that does not necessarily mean that this is the end of the Islamic State.
Amin Saikal, regional analyst of the Australian National University, also says the Islamic State is still capable of putting up strong resistance. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Attempts to isolate Russia over its actions in Ukraine seem to have failed, as President Vladimir Putin expanded the need to negotiate with Moscow after it began airstrikes in Syria. While President Putin forced Western attention, political analysts say the cost to Russia's security, relations, and economy is significant and means tougher times ahead. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Moscow.
Russia's airstrikes in Syria thrust it to the center of global efforts to tackle terrorism, refugees, and to forge a peace deal with Damascus. The need for the Kremlin's help was seen in Moscow as a victory, ending diplomatic isolation over its actions in Ukraine. Victor Mizin is with the Moscow State University's Institute of International Relations.
There's the general feeling here, I would say, among the political and military elites, that Russia now has the competitive edge over the West, that it's imposing its agenda.
Russia says it is bombing terrorists, but is accused of targeting mainly moderate rebels opposed to its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But President Vladimir Putin's military reach has come at a cost. Islamic State terrorists claimed responsibility for bombing a plane load of Russian tourists in revenge. Alexander Baunov is with the Carnegie Moscow Center.
It's the increased danger of terrorist attacks against Russians everywhere in the world and inside Russia itself.
Turkey shooting down a Russian bomber along its border dropped relations to a new low and underscored the risks of a wider conflict. While projection of power plays well at home, says Baunov, life in Russia is getting harder under a shrinking economy.
It's not destroyed or torn apart, but it's very weak, stagnating, not developing, lacking technology and lacking money.
A continued decline would eventually lessen support for Putin, says Baunov, though his ratings remain at a record high. Analysts say the popularity ratings are inflated by nationalist sentiment over what are considered in Russia to be big political achievements. These include Russia's hosting the 2013 Winter Olympics in Sochi, annexing Crimea in 2014, and projecting power in Ukraine and Syria. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Still to come, recipes from behind prison walls. This is VOA.
Green Beat, for a healthier planet.
What could be cuter than a hedgehog? Not much.
They have very funny little noses. They're pretty ridiculous looking.
Hillary Kepnick rescues African pygmy hedgehogs that are bred in the United States as pets. But their wild cousins in the UK also need to be rescued from urbanization. Henry Johnson is with the People's Trust for Endangered Species.
People putting up fencing, which is impermeable to hedgehogs, they need to be able to move through lots and lots of different gardens.
The conservation group says the number of hedgehogs have declined by 30% in the last 10 years. It suggests homeowners cut holes in their fences to create a hedgehog highway, allowing the creatures to freely forage. Kepnick says the hedgehogs are also vulnerable to predators and roadways.
So fixing the garden fences would be a really good step in the right direction.
Their only defense mechanism is curling up into a ball. Not always effective, but certainly part of their charm. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. The White House is expected to host the leaders of Asia-Pacific nations in the coming year. It will occur as the United States continues to push American power and influence in the area. But the Obama administration will face challenges as it seeks to further engage the region without increasing tensions with China. White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas has more.
Good afternoon, everybody.
President Barack Obama says America must be linked to the Asia-Pacific.
The Asia-Pacific is absolutely critical to promoting security, prosperity, and human dignity around the world. That's why I've devoted so much of my foreign policy to deepening America's engagement with this region.
In a bid to solidify the U.S. as a leader there, Obama has hosted regional leaders at the White House and met with others during multiple trips to the region. But the U.S. goal to create a peaceful and prosperous Asia-Pacific also hinges on Congress and whether it will ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement in 2016. The massive trade deal faces tough opposition. Analyst Christopher Johnson.
In most parts of Asia, economics is security.
Maritime disputes in the South China Sea will also continue to be a challenge, says analyst Mark Noland.
China's territorial claims and other actions have created anxiety among many of the smaller countries in the region, so they welcome the United States' presence. At the same time, they don't want to get drawn into confrontations between the United States and China.
The U.S. must walk a fine line, says Johnson.
The balancing act, if you will, between trying to reassure allies and partners in Southeast Asia in particular, but all throughout Asia, that the U.S. is there as responsive to its military alliance commitments with regard to growing Chinese activism in the region, but not make it look to the Chinese as if it's a containment strategy to try to damage China's interests in the region.
The U.S. has committed to helping Southeast Asian nations build up their maritime capabilities and called on China to halt reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas in the South China Sea. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, The White House.
Time for our social media segment with G. Abby Lee. Staying in Asia, South Korea and Japan have settled for an agreement on the issue of the so-called comfort women. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
So, first off, G, who are these comfort women?
So, it's actually a euphemism for sex slaves kidnapped by the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II. Japanese data say some 20,000 women were abducted, whereas Chinese scholars put the figure at around 410,000. Now, most of these victims were Korean teenage girls, but they also include Chinese, Southeast Asians, and even Dutch and Australian girls. On Monday, foreign ministers from Japan and South Korea agreed on the reparation of $8.3 million to aid the 46 surviving victims, all of them in their 80s and 90s. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, for the first time ever, also directly apologized for the atrocity.
So how is the online community responding to this latest development?
Ray, it seems like the only ones pleased with the settlement, at least online, are governments of the two countries and Washington. If you turn to the comment section of a New York Times article on the issue, you can see that quite clearly. The most popular comment is by a reader named Joshua Schwartz in the U.S. About 100 people liked his comment. His comment begins by mentioning the photo of the two foreign ministers shaking hands. Good picture at the top of the article. Two men come to an agreement about Japanese men abusing Korean women. $8.3 million also seems a little low, even bearing in mind that relatively few of these women are still living. it seems that future Korean-Japanese interests, bilateral ties, might have played a larger role than justice for the women. The second most popular comment is by a reader named Marie in Luxembourg. She wrote this: "What the woman wanted was the admittance of responsibility and a full and unreserved apology by Japan. And what does Japan do? They wash their hands clean with $8.3 million, request the removal from Korean soil of the statue that serves as a reminder of their crime, and get a concession from Korea to never criticize them on this issue ever again." The State Department, however, tweeted this: "U.S. applauds leaders of Japan and the Republic of Korea for reaching an agreement on the issue of comfort women." The State Department is on Twitter at StateDPT, and that's all for me today.
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GABLEE. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can follow all of us on International Edition at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Genes play a role in the development of cancer, but a new study suggests that genetic bad luck, which predisposes us to cancer, may be less of an influence on our risk for the disease than environmental factors. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Genes are not destiny seems to be the message from a new study looking at the relative risk of environmental factors on the development of cancer. In fact, says Yusuf Hanoun, who heads the Stony Brook University Cancer Center in New York, bad genes and DNA mutations appear to play a relatively small role in whether someone develops cancer. More important, he says, are environmental exposures such as inhaling tobacco smoke and eating red meat.
Around 70 to 90% of cancer incidence appears to be related to external factors, whereas only 10 to 30% is related to those intrinsic factors I talked about with mutation rates, etc.
Hanoun and colleagues used a number of complex approaches, including computer modeling, population studies, and genetic analyses, to arrive at their conclusions published in the journal Nature. For example, they looked at how stem cells in different parts of the body divide and mutate, noting that a similar number of genetic errors did not lead to cancer in all tissues. The researchers also investigated how people's risk of cancer changes when they move from one place to another, suggesting a strong role for external factors in the development of cancer. A study published earlier this year in the journal Science concluded most cancer was the result of genetic bad luck, but this study arrives at an opposite conclusion. Hanoun, however, does not entirely rule out genetic randomness when it comes to who gets cancer and who doesn't.
So there is an element of luck in that, but then there is a larger element of exposures and external factors that increase that risk tremendously.
Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
With New Year's just ahead, you may be planning a special meal or two for the occasion. One food item not normally considered is ramen noodles. It's long been a staple for students and young people just starting out, or those struggling to make ends meet because it's inexpensive and easy to make. Now, from a prison in California, former inmate Gustavo Goose Alvarez and his childhood friend, Clifton Collins Jr., a Los Angeles-based actor, have published a book called Prison Ramen. Clifton Collins spoke with International Audition's Jim Stevenson about how this idea started.
I went to go visit him. I just returned from Iowa because I was shooting The Experiment with Adrian Brody and Forrest Whitaker. And we'd had our own little fake movie riot. Unbeknownst to me, I walk into the production office, and I see that Chino had their own riot. So I was like, oh, my God, my dude's over there. So I try to get a hold of family and friends to find out if he's okay. And then when I came home and the prison got off a lockdown, I went to go visit him, and he pitched me this idea about a ramen cookbook because that's what everybody eats in there. And also at the end of the night when the riot was over, they left all the inmates outside, but the goose was inside, and he was able to get a bunch of the inmates together to cook a big old ramen spread, and they were able to feed the inmates through the door. They'd make these dishes of ramen. They would feed everybody all night long until the sun came up.
Now, this riot was between two different groups of prisoners, correct?
Yeah, it was between the blacks and Latinos, but once the riots are over, it's business as usual, and at the end of the day, everybody knows that they're all under the same roof in the same prison, so you know, that compassion kicks in and, you know, humanity kicks in.
And in this case, it was ramen that kicked in, something that really brought everybody together.
Yes, sir. It certainly did. And it did for this book, too. I mean, it got me to sit down with all, a bunch of my different celebrity friends. I've got many more that want to do book two now. When others get to learn from your mistakes and they don't have to actually do your mistake, that's a beautiful thing.
How much of a surprise was it to you when your friend pitched you this idea?
I mean, my jaw hit the floor. It's like I'm sitting there at a table on the yard, and I can still smell the burnt ashes from the dorms. He's like, I got an idea. Ramen cookbook. What do you think, Cliff? I'm like, okay. Are you all right? Yo, there's a riot here. Are you okay? Yeah, but a ramen cookbook, Cliff. Yeah, I heard you. So it was like, then we got into it, and I got the sentiment of it and the emotions and the intent behind it. That was profoundly beautiful to me. And I thought, how do we bring more of this message out? How do we touch more people? Because people are in and out of prison all the time, and there's different forms of incarceration. There's college, financial incarceration, emotional, love. So this is definitely a special book. Mm-hmm. And we donate a portion of the proceeds to Homeboy and Father Greg, which is a beautiful thing.
Clifton, I'm sure you've had plenty of ramen in your day, but were you surprised by some of the recipes that came out of this?
No, not at all. I've been around it too long. You know what? I take that back. There might have been a couple little like, huh? the ramenagra we had to talk about, the ramenagra for the conjugal visit. I was like, come on, man. Oysters and clams. And then, I mean, he put his stamp of approval on. He says, Cliff, trust me, dude. This is like, this is what the homies, when the lady comes and you need to impress, this is what you eat. I'm like, okay, I'll take your word for it.
So it's food that really transitions out of prison into normal life.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Yeah, you'd be amazed at how many of my friends I was talking to where I had to confess that I started eating ramen again, and they started laughing and would take me into their kitchen and open up a drawer filled with ramen.
Now that you're embarking on a second book, do you find that more difficult to be more creative, or are there that many more recipes out there?
Oh, there are a slew of recipes. We're not into the second book yet, but I've already got quite a few people coming up to me for book number two.
As our listeners get their hands on this book and look through some of the recipes, are there things that they need to be aware of as they try to do this at home versus how these were concocted in prison?
They're easier to cook, obviously, because you're not in jail. They're all just delicious dishes, man. You just got to sit down and freaking go into them, you know what I'm saying?
Know what he's saying. Actor Clifton Collins Jr., the book is titled Prison Ramen, Recipes and Stories from Behind Bars. It's available from Workman Publishing. William Shakespeare's tragedy Macbeth gets a new treatment from Australian director Judson Kurtzel. The film stars Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender as a doomed Scottish king and Oscar winner Marion Cotillard as his ambitious wife. International Editions' David Byrd takes a look.
Director Justin Kurtzel's Macbeth opens with the title character and his wife standing next to the grave of their only child. Their grief then transitions into a blood-soaked battle scene, after which a victorious Macbeth meets three witches who tell him that he shall be king of Scotland.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Clumps.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, that shall be king hereafter.
There's only one problem. Scotland has a king, Duncan, whom Lady Macbeth, played by Marion Cotillard, persuades her reluctant husband to murder when Duncan visits their castle.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn, as you have done to this.
Michael Fassbender, known for his roles in Shame, Inglourious Bastards, and the X-Men series, says taking on the role of the doomed Scott was something that required a lot from him.
There's just so many endless versions you can do and various sort of interpretations of it. It's just, which is very encouraging and also kind of depressing, because I would walk away thinking, God, you know, there was another thousand ways that could have been done. But just really becoming comfortable with it.
Colette Yard, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose, says she was reluctant to take the part until she talked to director Justin Kurzel.
The way he talked about the fact that he wanted to show that they were in love with each other and they wanted and he wanted to show, yeah, the humanity of those two people really got me and gave me the desire to be part of it.
Fassbender says Cotillard brought a new vision to the role and was a joy to work with.
She's a really very sort of unique actor, and the fact that she sort of really works very much in the moment-to-moment sort of elements of a scene. She doesn't come forcing something on a scene. She allows it to sort of organically sort of take place, and that's pretty rare.
The film was shot on location on Scotland's Isle of Skye, and the weather and the landscape play a large role in the story. Kurzel's vision also has the characters working in spare surroundings, not grand castles, but empty, dark, cold landscapes. Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation. Macbeth also stars David Thewlis as Duncan, Paddy Considine as Banquo, and Elizabeth Debicki as the ill-fated Lady Macduff. Macbeth is rated R for strong violence and brief sexuality. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, podcasts, and videos on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Tunisia, where the Arab Spring was born, democratic progress continues. On a recent visit there, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "The eyes of the world are on Tunisia, and America wants Tunisia to succeed." Despite great hardships and two major terrorist attacks, Tunisia has turned time and again to peaceful dialogue, consensus building, and compromise. As a result, Tunisia has built a powerful front against the Islamic extremists who oppose freedom, democracy, and everything that the Tunisian people are striving to build. The United States is committed to helping Tunisia move forward on its economic, democratic, and security objectives. The United States has already provided more than $700 million in foreign assistance to Tunisia since 2011 in the form of direct aid to democracy building, assistance for elections and civil society organizations, and security support. That's why the United States supports Tunisia's ambitious economic reform agenda. The government has proposed specific reforms, which they have forwarded now to the parliament. In an effort to help Tunisia achieve its goals, the U.S. has signed a declaration of intent, signifying its readiness to grant a third loan guarantee to Tunisia. In order to protect Tunisia's emerging democracy and growing prosperity, it is essential to enhance security cooperation. Toward that end, President Barack Obama recently announced his intent to designate Tunisia a major non-NATO ally. The U.S. will continue to stand with Tunisia in addressing all terrorist threats. Indeed, the United States welcomes Tunisia's decision to join the global counter-ISIL coalition in September. The terrorists associated with ISIL need to know this. Their days are numbered, and they will be defeated. There is no future, no path forward for ISIL, which does not lead ultimately to its destruction. The United States is committed to standing with the Tunisian people, to deepening the growing partnership that both nations share, and to continuing to support Tunisia's democratic journey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is 4.